Hello and welcome to Growing Up B2B. I'm Ed D'Elia, president of D'Elia Associates, the place where B2B brands go to grow. For over 60 years, and now across two generations, we've been helping B2B companies achieve next-level growth through brand distinction, quality lead generation, and sales enablement. Growing Up B2B was created for family business leaders who are passionate about growth, legacy, and making a lasting impact. Whether it's a multi-generational legacy or multiple family members working together, there's something truly magical about blending business with family. And we want to celebrate that right here on Growing Up B2B. So be sure to stick around to the end of the show and find out how you can be our next guest. Okay, let's get into it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Growing Up B2B. I'm your host, Ed D'Elia. I'm the second generation president of D'Elia Associates, the place where family B2B brands go to grow. Today, I'm joined by Tom Garrity of Compass Point. Tom has spent decades working alongside family-owned businesses, helping them navigate strategic planning, leadership transitions, and growth continuity. Early in his career, Tom helped build Larson Manufacturing from a $20 million company into a $250 million enterprise. That, among other leadership experiences within family businesses, gave him firsthand knowledge of how family-owned companies scale while protecting margins, brand position, and their legacy. Today, through Compass Point, Tom works closely with family business owners and their advisors to help them navigate a number of issues, one being a frequently misunderstood leadership topic, the difference between succession and transition. Tom, welcome to Growing Up B2B.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Ed. Thank you.
Great to have you. So, I got a lot of questions for you, but I want to start maybe at the beginning. Early in your career, you joined Larson Manufacturing. As I mentioned, it was at about a $20 million mark. Talk about that and that time frame and that period. What made that environment such a powerful leadership training ground for you? Because it seemed to have a definitive impact on you and your trajectory.
Yeah, it really did. So to be clear, I was a young kid coming out of college, and I was in the role or in the game as that company went from 20 million to 250 million. And I certainly wasn't in the finance group, and I didn't have access to that. But I stayed close to the Larson family and to a lot of friends there as I moved on in my career, and then started to understand the milestones. But it was a great company, and it was a second generation family business. It was known for giving back to employees, just this great employee culture, which, you know, again, I was a kid. I knew what that was, but I really didn't know. I didn't have any other experiences. And so when I joined them, I was fortunate to get into a management development program with them. And so I got into different aspects in the business. And I also, one of the things that Larson did extraordinarily well, Dale Larson, who was the president, the G2, he was great at finding talent. And again, I didn't really know that then. It was just like, mm-hmm. Oh, why don't we have somebody else here? But now in retrospect, right people, right time. And so he brought in a guy that was really going to help the manufacturing group go to the kind of the next level as we were scaling, mm-hmm. You know, the kind of things that needed to start happening in manufacturing to be able to manage operationally everything that was happening in the market. And I had ultimately ended up over in the distribution side of the business. And that's how I ended up moving out east. This is a company based in Brookings, South Dakota. And so my boss was really instrumental in, quite frankly, my whole life. It wasn't just at Larson. And at Larson, it was extraordinary. It's a guy that I learned so much from. And he had a way of letting me get into just enough trouble. And they go, all right, I'm not going to do it that way. You're gonna do this. And so I really didn't know what that style, because it was the boss that I had. It was later as I became a boss and failed or had successes and then looked back and went, all right, that made a lot of sense. So I was just fortunate to have great leadership at the top with Dale. Mm-hmm. And then my own personal, you know, good bosses and Dale's ability to attract great talent. And mm-hmm. I got exposed to a lot of those folks. And it was really instrumental and foundational for me as I continued both at Larson and then as I moved on in my career.
I think it's one thing to talk about right people, right seats, and it's something totally different to see it in application and say, okay, that's what that looks like. And that's what it looks like when it works, right?
When I read Good to Great, you know, which is one of the foundational books, anybody listening to this, please make sure you've read Good to Great at some point from Jim Collins. And Collins' basic premise was, you know, he's he kind of goes out with those books with a hypothesis. And so it was like, well, what is it that makes these great companies, which are really good company, or these good companies, go to great? And really, that's where the whole analogy of get the right people on the bus, get the wrong people off the bus, get everybody in the right seats. That was Jim. And he said, those great companies, they all figured out who first and then what. And I remember I was in consulting at that point. I had started Compass Point in 2003. And I remember reading that going, oh, come on. That's consulting talk. Who has time? Who can do that? Well, 25 years later, and also the two companies I ran, is exactly it. Who first? Do I have the right who's? Are they aligned to our values? Are they committed to the purpose? You know, what we're all about. We get that right. Yeah, they've got to be competent, but get that right. Often say to people, we hire people for what they can do and we fire them for who they are.
Yeah.
Have it backwards. Like, get the right people first, because you can't teach values. You can't teach behavior. I mean, people can change, but it takes a lot of commitment on everybody's part. And that's probably not the skill set that you have. So get the right people first. Obviously, you need to bring competency, but we can teach a lot of that skill set. I look back at Larson, I'm like, man, did we do that well? Again, when it's your first job, you're just kind of like, there's a bunch of good people and we seem to be doing good and I'm getting opportunities. But it's, when I got out in the trenches myself and found how hard it was to grow businesses and the two that I ran and then start this one, it's like, man, how did we do that so well? And, a lot of basic blocking and tackle. But it's easy to say, but hard to do.
Yeah. And in the look back on that too, I mean, that's a company that didn't just scale, they scaled dramatically.
Yeah.
So, loud and clear here, you're pointing to, well, part of the ability for us to do that was finding great people and putting them in the right positions and empowering them to do great things. But what else, like, if you look back, Tom, what else did, were some other takeaways of being and experiencing a company that had that rapid growth momentum?
Yeah. Again, I didn't know any of this while I was in the business. It's afterwards, right? When I look back and went, oh, that was a really smart move. So I moved out to the East Coast, into Allentown, Pennsylvania in 1986 to open up distribution. And the strategic play was basically, there's a lot of people that live out there. And about 33% of the nation's population is an 8-hour drive. And of course, 2 hours were into the ocean. So there's a lot of people in and around this Lehigh Valley area. And that's why it's become such a big distribution hub. So that's kind of what we did. We came out, opened up distribution, and our marketplace at that time was independent lumber dealers like Tom and Ed. And we might be a Service Star group or an Ace for buying power. And there were some super regionals and some larger, kind of call them larger super regionals, like Pergament was out here in the East Coast and Channel and Rickle. But here comes Home Depot. I move out here in August of 86, and September of 86, Home Depot moves out of Atlanta. First two stores are Paramus and Lakewood, New Jersey. And the whole market changed. Now, again, I didn't know that while I was in the middle of it. And quite frankly, we should probably have never gotten their business. But we had great sales organization. We got those two stores. And then every store that they built, that was our store. And they were big. It wasn't Tom and Ed, who maybe we sold 50 doors a year, which was great. These guys were like $300-$400 door opening orders. And then every weekend, with replenishing. So every new store was our store. The growth was tremendous. Lowe's comes out of Atlanta or out of North Carolina. They're not just going to watch Home Depot take the market. And Menards is in the Midwest. So that was we just got on that train and executed. So when I look back and go, well, yeah, all right, that's easy to say, but how in the world? And how do we protect our margins? Which I didn't know any of that when I was there, but later in my career going, man, when you grow like that and the target gets on your back, and especially you get into the mass merchandiser space, the volume's great, but how do you hold margin? And this is another just brilliant piece on Dale's part, building a strong operational strategy that continued to find, how do you pull costs out of the product? And it wasn't by beating people up. It wasn't about, wringing every last effort. But it was being very operationally disciplined, right? We knew how long it took to do every component of making a door or a window, whatever we were running through. And we began to automate more. So the automation began to take, and it wasn't about getting rid of people. It was, you know, we had automation to help speed and improve quality and get product out the door and deploy people elsewhere. So it was those lessons as I watched, again, we had a tremendous sales organization, but it was backed with an operational strategy and really good people. And they worked well together, back to leadership. Dale had this, he's just a Larson, right? And the whole upper Midwest is full of the Scandinavians and just a humble servant. But man, smart, wicked smart. And to build a team and keep those people talking and communicating. So sales wasn't running off on anything that operations didn't know about. And they challenged each other. It wasn't like a pretty dance every day. But they worked well together with the whole mindset of this is about the customer, take care of the customer. And just really a great success story. And in all of that, take care of your people. Keep hiring great people and take care of people. I mean, they paid an unbelievable profit sharing, I don't know, from the mid-70s on through my time when I left in the mid-90s. You know, had millionaires walking off the door line. They put in a big effort, but they also got rewarded well. And so you can't do that if you don't have a successful company. And so along with being financially successful, it's the full circle. It took care of his people, took care of the customers, was able to take care of the community and the bigger community with philanthropy. It just was a great success story.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So I want to touch on something you raised about the tension between, I think you said, sales and operations. And it reminds me of a very young version of me. Went to my first sales meeting at a manufacturing client. And I was kind of baffled because the first half of the first day, it seemed like it was a therapy session for the manufacturing and operations to play nicely with sales and vice versa. And I'm like thinking, why are we spending, aren't they all part of the same company? Why are we doing all this and, you know, like hugging and talking things out? Like what's, you know, but then I started to realize, okay, clearly there's some tension here that maybe is inherent. So when you see that dynamic now, and how do you address that now? When you see that showing.
Well, the first thing, I think that tension's good, but it's recognizing it and talking about it and helping people see what's happening. Like, hey, it's natural that sales and marketing fight with one another because sales is always saying, if you gave us decent leads, we could sell more. And marketing's going, if you guys were any good, all the leads we're producing, you could actually build our business. When it's so far over to either side of that, of course, it's not healthy, but having that conversation around, in that case, who's our core customer? Are we actually out generating leads in that core customer space? Do we have a good solid sales process that takes in the language you and I might use, a marketing qualified lead and move it into your sales process? So I think those tensions are good. It's calling them out and again, getting everybody clear on where are we going? I mean, big piece of the work we do almost with every company is we get into their strategy house and into their operating system as a business. But it starts with what's the vision? You know, where do we want to be in 10 years, let's say? Give me a sense, and Collins used this in Good to Great, he called it the BHAG, you know, the big, hairy, audacious goal. Enough to stretch us, attainable, but a lot of good things are going to have to happen to make that happen. But now you know where your North Star is. And building back from that, you know, what are the big strategic moves, let's say, over the next 3 years we're going to have to make? And you're doing that with a leadership team and getting everybody aligned around that and the different disciplines on that leadership team, right? It's not just the operations guys and not just the sales guys. It's finance, it's ops, it's sales, it's might be engineering, might be IT. Who knows? In a size, a team that's reasonable, right? 6 to 8 people, get all of them aligned around a common vision with a purpose that everybody's believes in and everybody aligned to the same set of values. You've got a good shot to pull that off, right? And it's their job then to cascade that out of the organization. So it's that kind of communication, bringing back to the table, you know, having a good rhythm of meeting and accountability so things don't get lost. So easy to get off the rails. There's so many distractions. So, nope, we said these are the priorities. What's happening? What are we doing next? What's the next 30 days? Where are the roadblocks? Where are we creating our own internal roadblocks? What's happening externally? Yeah, having those kinds of conversations, all with a common goal out here, not a goal from my department only or me personally. What are we all working towards? That takes a lot of work. But when you do that well, that's how you work across those departments and those disciplines to get everybody on the same page.
Great point. Great point. So, obviously, through Compass Point, you're working with many different shapes and varieties of family-owned and family-governed businesses. When you look at the family-owned business model, what do you think makes those types of companies fundamentally different than, say, a professionally managed or, founder-led, or maybe a PE-backed organization, or venture-backed, or even a public enterprise? What makes the privately held family governed business a bit of a different model than the others in your mind?
Yeah, I think the big thing is they live in a system. They live in what we call the family business system, which are three domains. So of course we all know the business, and that's super important. We got to build a great business and maximize value and have a business that's delivering returns. But also in that system is the family. It's not just, oh, these people that own the business or have maybe some members that work in the business, and they themselves are a system, right? And they're intersecting with that business. Some are in the business, some aren't, but they absolutely, even if they're not in the business, they're influencing. And spouses influence, uncles and aunts, whatever. And then you have another third domain, the ownership domain. All three of those circles intersect one another. So some people are in all three, right? All three domains. They've got three hats. That's challenging and takes incredible, emotional intelligence and discipline. That if you and I are working together, you're my brother and we're working, I got to make sure that in the conversation, whatever we're having, I'm consciously going, I got this hat on. This is either my family hat, I'm going to talk to you as a brother, or it's my business hat, I'm talking to you business to business, or it's an ownership hat. There are three different hats. And not recognizing that, that's when the crazy stuff, the TV stuff that we see, right? That starts happening. Like it just, you gotta recognize what hat and the conversation I'm having in that point. So that's one thing. And then recognizing there's those different perspectives are critically important. There's, if you look at that Venn diagram, there's seven different perspectives. So, they're all influencing that family business system. So again, family that doesn't work in the business nor has ownership, but man, they're impacting the system. They're laying on the pillow at night going, you're working too hard. Your dad's a putz. What are we doing? Are we getting anywhere? Whatever. You can't say that's not impact. So that part of the system needs a voice because why are we doing what we're doing? Where are we going? They don't need to know all the details. They just need a voice. If you don't know, then you're going to make up your own story. So the job is to make sure that we're crafting the story that's actually happening and communicating it. So it's so easy to say, oh, communication is so important in these family business systems, but communication is so important in these family business systems, right? You can't communicate enough. I always say, if you ever get people mocking you, then you're like, all right, we're on the right track. I think I got us there. And then that'll change because people will, systems change, people come in and out but I think that's the big thing that I see is that system. And then there's all sorts of challenges that come with it, right? As family, who we are today is not, we didn't fall out of the womb like that, right? Most of this stuff that we're dealing with, and we all have family issues. So it's not like, oh, the family businesses that are successful, they don't have any crap going on. No, everybody does. Every family's got something going on. It's your ability to manage it. It's your ability to deal with, the dynamics of a family and not let it get in the way and destroy the business. That's a lot of work. But it's the work that needs to be done. You don't do it. Well, that's why these things, one of the reasons anyway, they flame out.
It's a very healthy perspective, though, and a great point you raised is that one doesn't necessarily have to be in an operations capacity in a family business model. A lot of times these, I'll just call them ancillary persons who may or may not be involved, who may not even have set foot in the family business can carry substantial influence on many things. And I think a lot of people don't fully acknowledge that or appreciate that.
Or do something about it. I can't tell you how many times we've been in and they go, oh, I'm not having that conversation. Not going to open that can of worms. Well, Don't pretend that can of worms is not open. It's open somewhere, and it's just getting messier. The longer you wait, it's going to be more difficult, maybe even to a point where there it's not insurmountable. So, and I don't want to say this like it's easy. It's not easy, but that's why we work with clients. We're helping them have those tough conversations, or the business conversation, or the family conversation, or the ownership conversation, and then some structure in there that helps them, work better together. And just think, to your point, those, let's say owners. Now you can have an owner that works in the business. You can have an owner that doesn't work in the business. Most and or could be in the family. So, and some maybe no aren't in the family. So you've got that owner. Now, as you go generationally, especially, there's gonna be more and more owners that don't work in the business. Their perspective is different than the ones in the business. The easy thing to go is, oh yeah, they're just waiting for their check, and some are. But you need to talk about that. As it is our business, we're the owners. So what do we want? And it's not easy, but that's the work that needs to be done. What do we want with this? What's our vision for this family business? And what do we want to see, for instance, for growth? Or what do we want to see for return? What do we want to see never broken? We never want to see our brand dismantled. This brand is super important. We're not going to do business in this country. I don't know what these high level goals. What do we want for distributions? What's going to be our policy around that? Are we ever going to take on debt, or are we going to do this all our growth with cash? Whatever you've decided, that's so critical for the executive team in the business, some of which might be owners and some of which may or may not be family, especially as you go generationally, hopefully not just family at that executive team, bring in more professional outside. Not that the family's not professional, just bring more talent to the table. They need to know. What are we working towards? Make sure our BHAG's aligned to what the family wants. And now you've got good synergy. You've got owners supporting the business, making, good relationships, connections. You got a family that's wired in knowing, hey, there's opportunities here for the kids. And we could even have an introductory program when they're 14 to do a plant tour, or I don't know. It's different for different families, but that's what's possible. But you gotta think like that system. And be working in all those domains to make the whole enterprise. It's enterprise continuity. It's not just, well, I got to find somebody to take on my job. I mean, it's the whole
When
enterprise.
so when there is a generational transition in play, right?
Yeah.
So it's maybe the founder was the mom of the dad, and the son or daughter is looking to step up and be that next CEO. What do you look for in that individual to say, all right, they've got it or they don't? I mean, do you size up that individual? And if so, what are you looking for from that person that's about to take the next step and succeed in leadership?
I think I look for the same thing that I look. I would not necessarily all the same, but some common characteristics. People that are curious, people that are problem solvers, people that have confidence, all wrapped in humility. That's a pretty strong package. And prior to all that, did they say yes to this opportunity? Did they get the chance to say yes? That's so critical, right? Did you say yes? Not because, I got to do this for my family or for my dad or my mom, or, I'm the fourth gen, there's nobody else. Like, that's not a reason. That probably will be another reason they'll flame out. Because these things, Ed, you need passion like nobody's business, because there's a million reasons to Sunday why you should not do this. Those days when people don't pay you and they have employee problems and all this insanity, and you work for a lunatic. We work for ourselves. We know you would never put in the hours you put doing this when we do this, but it's so rewarding. And what can be for the family? So that passion, they gotta have it. And I think the other thing is, and they don't necessarily have that at 25, but you gotta kind of see some of that. Like, did you show any of that ever in your life? Did you play any sports where you? Did you take on an instrument? Did you do something where you wanted to excel? If you were just cruising, or because of your last name, life's been pretty good, that's probably not going to make a great successor. And those are the hard conversations that we have with our owners. And we can, right? Worst thing they can do is fire us. With a family member, the conversation is so hard to have. It's so Because they probably haven't built good governance. They haven't had that conversation yet. The table hasn't been set well. And they go, you know what? You're just not the right successor. It's probably not going to be the way that goes well, but can lead to that if you've been sort of setting the table well. So all of that. And I think the other piece is they got to have an entrepreneurial spirit. And whatever that looks like, you don't have to be the great Steve Jobs, and you're going to figure out, but you've got to have a mindset of, what's possible, what's next, because it's needed all over the organization. You need an entrepreneurial mindset around your people. You need an entrepreneurial mindset around the market, around your products, around your the problem solving. And that's what founders have, right? That's how the darn thing got started in the first place. So making sure you're second gen, third gen, because it just gets harder as you go out, right? Just more complex, bigger, all those things. And they don't need to be the only entrepreneur, but man, they need to have some entrepreneurial mindset to them.
And I think I see it the same way. I sometimes frame it a little differently is I look for whether or not they have their own vision. And it doesn't have to be a good one, as you say, at the age of 25 or 27 or whatever age they might be as they're stepping in, but just that they have one. And something that's different than maybe what mom or dad, or doing it a little better than mom or dad, or doing it like mom or dad did, which is not to say that they shouldn't honor those, the legacy or honor the values, but typically, when a generational transition is going on, it's going on all around. You know, it's just not happening in the ecosystem of that business. It's going on with customers, suppliers, the greater world, the demands of consumers, the greater economies are all shifting and moving in lockstep. So, to say we're just going to kind of do what we've always been doing, I don't know, is a winning formula. Probably not.
Probably not. Probably not. And you bring up a good point because, the stats most people know, maybe 33% of family businesses make it to the second generation, plus or minus 12% to the third, maybe 3 or 4% to the fourth. And I always say it's not because the subsequent generations are dumb. It's because we haven't done a lot of the right things in developing them, the good governance in the business, those kind of, and developing leaders. But also, as you were saying, this, what got you here? I mean, it's the classic, what got you here is not necessarily going to get you there. That's including the vision. It doesn't mean you, to your point, that you have no respect or honor the values and purpose. No, honestly, values are values. If they're changing consistently, those aren't values. I don't know what those are, but they're sure not values, right?
True.
Values are that handful of rules that we go, hey, this is the game. This is how we play. This is how we treat one another. This is how we behave. But that vision is going to be super important. Markets change, people change, everything you just said. So, and if you get stuck in, well, grandpa always did it this way, or dad, well, you'll be part of the statistics probably.
Yeah. So I want to come back around to a point that I made in the opening, which was, you often distinguish the difference between succession and transition. Can you walk that a little bit more for us, please?
Yeah, I just watch parents get caught up in this, just an easy trap to fall in. And it's probably because maybe it's the way they came in. But what I mean by that is succession is leadership. It's leadership transition. It's somebody coming into a position in the, let's say, succession in the business, into a seat in the business. And we need to develop them as leaders. And we can talk about that more later, what that might look like. But that's succession. Transition is ownership. Who will own this stock? Who will I sell this stock to? Who will I gift this stock to? And what often happens is, well, I'm selling or I'm gifting the stock to my oldest son, Pat. So Pat will be the CEO, or I'm gifting 60% of it to Pat. And since that's the majority, Pat will be the CEO. And I can't tell you how many times I look and go, nope, that's not the CEO. Pat's a good guy. He can't lead this place. I have a leadership, look his leadership in him, and he doesn't even like people or whatever, right? I mean, I'm exaggerating, but it's back to right people, right seats. That's succession, transition, ownership. And you got to be thoughtful. And you and I and our brother advisors, the CPAs and estate planners and financial advisors, it's one of the things we can bring to the table when we all work together is bringing our perspectives on decision making. God, one of the worst things I see happen, for instance, is one kid's working in the business and three aren't, and the parents decided to divide the business up 25, 25, 25, 25. It's like, gosh, there's so many more better ways to do it than that. And that could work, but boy, you better have done work with your family so those non-working family members have clear governance and what say, probably shouldn't have any say in how the business is being run. Compensating the guy or the woman who's running the thing well because they're creating all the value. But there's other ways to do it. You don't need to give everybody a piece of it. You can give them another piece of the estate that equals the value of the business. And And that gets tough and complicated maybe as the enterprise values get larger, but that's why you come to the table, because you could create an estate plan that's brilliant for tax and it will kill the family. And then once the family's killed, so is the business. So now everything's lost. So don't do that.
There's a and I believe that as part of Compass Point, you actually do workshops on this, and I think this is really valuable to talk about and for our listeners to hear. But you actually bring together owners and their circle of influence, which I think spoke loudly to me because a lot of times in that circle of influence, there may be financial advisor, maybe accounting, there may be banking, there may be an estate attorney and the like. They always talk about team, but they seem to just talk about it. They never really always play on the same team, nor do they necessarily work and play together. Yet you have a method for bringing them together in a meaningful way. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, so you're right. And I, you know, I ran to, so after Larson, by the way, I ran two, not my family, but two family businesses. And I remember the first one, my CPA and attorney were arguing through me, and I was too young to know better. That's a classic triangle. Like, don't do that. Don't. They needed to call each other, but I was like, well, I guess I'll try to see if I can help solve this. Like, it's not my problem to solve. I got a problem. You two are here. I'm paying you. Solve it. That was sort of an early introduction to that. So when we're involved with clients, we get all the advisors together. We want to, we're certainly cognizant of, you know, we can't be just spending our clients' money and not having foolish meetings, but we can do a lot over a Zoom call or over a quick meeting at least once a year, where everybody knows where we're trying to go as a business, what we're trying to do in the family. So any work they're doing, everybody's on the same page. It's not being duplicated, and or even more importantly, somebody hears something and they go, hold it, that, what did you guys, here's an idea how we might address that, right? And so now we're using that collective intelligence versus hoping they figure it out in the silo they're working in. So it's really, it, and if we're not involved, you know, what I would say to people in the audience is somebody on your advisor team needs to be the quarterback and just keeping everybody abreast and on the same page, helping you get, you have goals, you pay them, you're the customer, tell them what you want. And make sure everybody's aligned to get you where you want to get to. That's their job. And sometimes we think, well, but you know, they're an attorney, they're really smart. Oh, they are, but you're the customer. It's their job to do what you need it done. Not tell them how to do it, just here's where I want to get to. Help me get here. So you got
I
to be
would think.
a little bit of that confidence piece and just recognizing, like, of course I should do that. Of course I. You would do that if you went to buy a boat. You wouldn't go, well, yeah, not quite sure on does this float? Like, you know, we're not having that conversation. So anyway.
I get it. But it's, I mean, I would have to think it would make them all collectively smarter, more valuable to the business, each in their own discipline. So I think it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does. And they another plus of that is they get together and they have opportunities to cross refer, and lots of good things can come out of all of that, right? Everybody's winning. So the client wins, they win, everybody gets a little bit smarter. It's a good formula.
Absolutely. So I'm going to turn the tables on you a little bit because when we spoke before this session, you told me your daughter recently joined the business. So how has that influenced your thinking about leadership transition now that you're seeing it starting to play out under your own organization, Tom?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. That's what I'll tell you. And Catherine, my daughter, is brilliant, and she's so right for this role. But I never, we never talked about it. You know, I've had this business for 25 years. I've got four kids. Never talked my wife and I about the kids coming in the business. It just that wasn't part of the conversation. And there's another story another day of how it came to be with Catherine, but she is absolutely the right person. So what have I learned? We so highly encourage that next gens work outside the family business. That's not just from Compass Point. That's a pretty common practice, a good common practice in family business. It's not just so they bring outside experience into the ecosystem, which is super important. So new ideas, new inputs. But they've experienced what it's like when nobody cares what their last name is. So if there's no cash, you ain't getting a paycheck. If you're going to get your butt chewed out because you did a poor job, you're getting your butt. That's important in life because life's tough. So it's so hard to not have a little bit of protectionism for your child, even when you're committed to, like, I know that would be the wrong thing to do. So they're working outside, and it also builds credibility for the people inside when your child comes in, and for them, right? I've done something. I've had success. So Catherine was in med device sales with B. Braun and Boston Scientific, two great companies. Learned a boatload, and so she was able to bring a lot of that, of course, to the business. But she built credibility with the team when they realized, wow, she's done a pretty good job out in the market, and she had a lot to learn coming in. That really helped her and helped her stand on her feet, and it gave her confidence. Right? It wasn't like, coming in and going, I think every next gen knows if you don't, you got a massive target on your back, and everybody's waiting for you to trip up or be a putz or do something stupid or, the nepotism or whatever. You just have to be so cognizant of, sorry, but that's the way it is. So you're gonna have to go the extra mile. You're gonna have to put in the extra time. That again, that credibility and that confidence that comes with that's such a key piece. And then the rest of it, from my standpoint, is, and it's one th it's just like your work. It's one thing to talk to clients and talk about what needs to be done, put together plans with them, start executing it, on the street. But when you're doing it yourself, the big wake up for me is, we preach all the time that succession planning, which what this will also be transition planning. Catherine will also own it. But succession right now, it's not an event, it's a process. We're in the process, and the amount of time this process takes, it's enormous. There's so much institutional knowledge that founders have, but even the next gens and the next, so getting that transitioned out, all the relationships transferred, building confidence in the company that this next gen, and getting them exposed to the different aspects of the business. Not a month in finance, and not a another month out in the shop floor if you got manufacturing, or in our case, maybe working in one of the particular aspects, consulting areas that we work in, but having meaningful time in there, 6 months, 6 months, 6 months. Catherine's getting her MBA. That's a 2-year commitment. This is just a lot of work to be done, and you got to be aware of, and it could possibly not work out. Right? Things happen, things happen. People change minds. Of course, I'm an optimistic person by nature anyway, but I'm super optimistic. Hey, this is it. But things happen. I lost my first wife to breast cancer. That's not what I imagined when I was 30 years old and Denise and I got married. And so, you got to do all this planning and work, and also give yourself enough runway that if it weren't to work out, you have time still to, what's next? What's my next plan? But also that you're not so darn burnt out when it's all over. You work too hard. Why go right to the edge that and kind of just flick you in the back and you fall in the hole and they throw dirt over you? Like, it doesn't have to be that way. And I think, I always say you need to draw a line in the sand. I can't emphasize that enough. Because once you say, I'm out, it triggers all sorts of things. First of all, everybody on the team is like, oh, okay, that's the game. The successor has a timeline. Your work with the successor has a timeline. It's not that I'm not going to continue to help afterwards if Catherine needs help, but there's a line. She will become the president CEO of the company, and we're building all the leadership track that she's advancing as we're going along. But that also gets my mind, and I've been blessed. Love found me again and got married last year. And Lauren and I have a new life that we're working towards. So we're talking about that now. Like, and that's such an important part of, this transitions, and this, especially when you're, the senior generation is, I'm 66 years old. I never sat around as a little kid and thought, yeah, I'll be 90 one day. But the likelihood now is I'm probably going to make it into my 90s. Something else, something crazy doesn't happen. So That's almost 30 more years. That's almost another third of my life. Like, I want to do a lot of good living. And if you're
Sure.
not preparing for that as a as an owner or president in this, in some cases, you know, and leaving a company, bad things happen, right? People get
Sure.
depressed, their health goes in the tank. Figuring out what's next is such an important, and especially when you've been wired to, you know, as a as an entrepreneur, yeah, I love to golf, but I'm not doing that every day. I'm gonna do that hopefully a fair amount, but I got other things I want to do and
Sure.
that Lauren wants to do. So,
So every now and again, and you might see this too. So I'm thinking of, it was a fairly large distribution company, and I think third generation. You know, so the grandfather founded, the son was very much entrenched as the CEO. I went there to visit him, and I saw this older gentleman kind of walking along. I'm like, "Well, who's that?" He's like, "Well, that's my dad." And I'm like, "How old is he?" He's like, "He's 94." So I'm like, "What's he do here?" He's like, "Oh, he still comes in every day." And he does. So every now and again, and I see, you know, okay, there's a founder, or in this case, it's a second gen, but they just struggle to step away or step back. And I guess I'm wondering, what are they really afraid of losing? You know, because clearly the business has transitioned, you know, yet they're still, you know, they're still there. And I guess you know, after hearing you talk about, hey, there's things I want to do in my life, and I'm thinking, yeah, when I'm, you know, if I make it to 90, there's other things I want to do, and I'm not going to be, you know, if I transition this to one of the twins or something, you know, but they stick around. Like, what's going on there from your perspective?
So first of all, I think like being a parent, in my opinion, if you're parenting well, then you're sacrificing a lot. This is the way it goes.
Yeah.
So I think part of transitioning a business is sacrificing. You need to get out of the way, and it's hard. Peter Drucker used to say, the final success of the CEO is to find his or her successor and get out of the way and let them run it. That's it. It's get out of the way and let them run it. It doesn't matter. You can come back every once in a while. But what I think what happens is their identity is so tied with that business and with the successor or whatever, their friendships. So many of them have so many friendships tied up, both in the business, literally the employees, but their vendors and their customers, and they've done nothing to build anything outside of that, some identity outside of that ecosystem. And the thought of pulling it again, that's why it's so important to be working on this next chapter. The statistics are enormous. It's like 40% of family business owners without a plan going forward go into literally depression. And if you've ever either had a family member or you've been there yourself, I mean, that's not just like I'm sad. Like, this is a bad place to get. And then health problems, more physical health problems start to follow. So I remember we were working with Mrs. T's pierogies. That's a Ukrainian potato pocket. And they're up in the coal country in Shenandoah. And Tom Towardzik is a third generation owner. And I remember talking to him one time, you know, like, what are you going to do when you don't do this? Because he would, the family and Tom were so synonymous with these, you know, Mrs. T's. Mrs. T was his grandmother, you know, so started him in the Catholic Church and sold him as a fundraiser. And three generations later, they're around the nation. I mean, it's a great story, and everything they did for that community and employees and the family. And he said, oh, that's not going to be a problem. He goes, I figured out a long time ago that my self-actualization cannot come from this business or I'm screwed. And Tom was and he's still the CEO. He's a bit of a heady guy. But if you remember Maslow's hierarchy of needs, at the top is self-actualization. That's really it. He knew, if I let this business become my self-actualization, I'll never get out. I'll never let go. How am I ever going to find a successor that wants me hanging around and not giving them any authority to take the business, just like you said earlier, with their vision to move forward? He knew that was going to be a problem. So it's work. The emotional readiness of that transition, that's a job to be done. Back to succession. It's not just about the person and transferring their leadership. And it's like getting yourself ready. What are you going to do when you do this?
That's a huge point, and that's definitely some great self-awareness from that leader, and great food for thought for our listeners. So let's fast forward 10 years out from now, with maybe Catherine at the leadership helm. What do you hope, through the guidance of Compass Point, that family leaders will be doing better or differently than they are today?
I'm going to say spend. So I talked about that ecosystem, right? The mm-hmm. family business system. You got the family, the ownership, and the business. Those three, think of those three circles, and they intersect one another, that Venn diagram. What I hope they're doing is spending more time as a family, working together around a common purpose that they all believe in. And where does the business fit into that? Because that health in that family, and any family member that works in the business, that kind of alignment helps you get through all the nonsense that's going to happen. You know, it's easy to say, well, you shouldn't treat them like your son, or you shouldn't treat them, your brother, like your brother at home. Yeah, well, it's easy to say that, and it's easy to fall in the trap, right? And we get into these familial behaviors, mm-hmm. and they go generation. They didn't just start with you guys. You know, if your dad was a particular way, right? Good chance his dad was that way. And probably sure. learning that and understanding, hey, we didn't just show up this way. Like, and we don't have to continue. Like, we could be different. It's not baked in. We have a choice here. And so when families have that kind of awareness and commit to working on themselves like that, boy, that's a strong family. And then if that family owning a business, providing talent potentially, or at least leadership, that's the success of a generational family business.
Yeah, beautifully said. Thank you for that. Last question. If any of our listeners wanted to learn more about you, talk to you, or learn more about the work you do with Compass Point, what's the best way for them to connect?
Yeah, so on LinkedIn, you can find me, Tom Garrity, and also on our website, compasspt.com. And my email and cell and everything's on there. So
wonderful.
Happy to have a conversation with anyone.
Excellent. Well, as we've learned, leadership transitions are some of the most defining moments in the life of a family business. Tom, thank you for sharing your insights on how transitions can help companies protect legacy while still moving forward. Again, we've been speaking with Tom Garrity of Compass Point, and I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and this has been another episode of Growing Up B2B. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ed. It was a real privilege.
Hey, thanks so much for tuning into Growing Up B2B. To explore more episodes and insights, visit podcast.deleonet.com. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating or review on your podcast platform of choice. Having worked with hundreds of family-led businesses across my career, and being a second-generation leader myself, I'm on a mission to help every family business I meet achieve next-level growth for their organization. So feel free also to connect with me on LinkedIn and let's support each other. You can also find out more about my company at DeLeaNet.com. Again, I'm your host, Ed D'Elia, and thanks so much for joining us today. Take care.